Commission. Then we'll brief over to the Commission. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. My name is Trevor Fowler. I'm a commissioner. I wish to just introduce our chairperson, who was recently appointed from effective the 17th of August, Dr. Mbava. Dr. Mbava holds a PhD at Public and Development Management and MBA at Stellenbosch University, as well as a bachelor's degree in economics from Smith College in Massachusetts, USA. And she brings a wealth of experience, including being a member of various boards and has headed monitoring and evaluation units in public entities. And she has also been a board member of the South African Monitoring and Evaluation Association. She's a research fellow at the Public and Monitoring and Evaluation at Stellenbosch University, the University School of Public Leadership. And Dr. Mbava has exemplary academic awards and achievements. So it's my honor to introduce her. The members of the committee, Honorable Chair, would know that our previous chairperson had passed away, and it has been some time since we had an acting chair who was in his place, and now we have the formal chair. We welcome Dr. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Yeah, I think it's just proper from the committee, just not to interrupt you. Thank you very much for that, for the introduction for the chairperson. So as the committee, that we also officially welcome the Dr. Mbava. You are very much welcome, Doctor, and we believe that we will work very well in making sure that we give a very good service to the people of South Africa. And thank you very, very much. Greatly appreciated. Thank you, Commissioner. You can continue.
Okay. Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson, for the warm welcome. Thank you so much, my fellow Commissioner, Professor Fowler, Chairperson, and members of the House. I have with me my fellow Commissioner Trevor Fowler, and I also have the Secretariat from the Commission, Dr. Kay Brown, and I also have the research team headed by Mr. Chan Sang, and also other members of the Commission, Ms. Ansia Maharaj Dara. Thank you so much again. I want to just give an opening statement, members, before I hand over to my colleagues who will get into detail about our submission. Honorable Chairperson and members, as you know, the Financial and Fiscal Commission tables its recommendations for the 2022-23 Division of Revenue against a backdrop of a very, very fragile economic environment after the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. The pandemic, as we know, is causing damage to the economy and to people's livelihoods. It has posed many challenges, including the efficacy of our macro-fiscal system in accommodating pandemic-induced challenges. It has also intensified the existing inequalities and condemned many people in our country to unemployment and poverty. Questions abound on the impact of the pandemic on the state's fundamental obligations, the progressive realization of citizens' basic rights as enshrined in the Constitution. Such questions arise because the pandemic has highlighted the shortfalls in access to basic services and food, both in terms of quantity and quality. And it has, in fact, heightened imbalances and conflicts in our society, especially when we consider the gender dimensions. It has further exposed the limitations in our country's oversight, in accountability and leadership mechanism as well. Honorable Chairperson and honorable members, the theme of our submission this year is the effects of COVID-19 and the changing architecture of subnational government financing in South Africa. As the Commission, we believe that a comprehensive and evidence-based analysis of the socioeconomic impact of the pandemic is key to developing a set of informed recommendations that can contribute to turning around the economy to achieve an inclusive and sustainable growth trajectory. The Commission's recommendations, therefore, seek a recovery process that is sustainable and leaves no one behind. Honorable Chairperson and honorable members, the submission that we're going to table today is divided into four sections. The first part will speak to the macroeconomic impact of the pandemic. The second part of our submission will speak to the implications of the pandemic on local government finances. Thirdly, access of the progressive realization of people's basic rights and their access as well to socioeconomic rights as entrenched in the Constitution is going to be covered on the third part of our presentation. Finally, Chairperson and members, this submission also will look at the oversight and leadership, which we believe that it could assist local government to go back and be on track to meet the needs of our citizens and to also ensure better value for money that has been spent. I'm now going to hand over to our head of research, Mr. Chen Sang, who with the team will take us thoroughly through the presentation. Over to you, Chen.
Thank you very much, Brock. Thank you very much. May I continue?
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, Honourable Chair and members. Let's look at the context within which the submission is tabled. The shock of the COVID-19 pandemic was significant, with the jolt of a negative 51.7% decline in the annualized quarter-to-quarter change in quarter two of 2020. We are still feeling the residual impacts of that significant shock. So with that shock of this tremendous deterioration, is also, of course, also look at this sort of rebound that is 67.3%. And in economics, any shock, whether it be negative or positive, at this large magnitude, it's never a good news, because it creates uncertainty as well as the risk of future shocks that is going forward. On the demand side, firms are busy restocking, as we noticed recently with the reopening as well as resuming of activities. However, that resumption is relatively marginal, as well as it is very small by comparison to pre-crisis levels. GDP by industry shows roughly the same trend, with the volatility caused. The market is left by the pandemic is much more pronounced. In terms of the labor market. We are currently at almost 43.2% by the unofficial definition of unemployment. It was at 32.5% in the official definition of unemployment, but as of 2 days ago, the latest stats of the quarterly labor force survey from Statista showed that it has now gone up to about 34%. The fiscal position has deteriorated, with gross debt to GDP reaching above 80%. Provincially, even disaggregated regional data for GDP, though, just like to warn the members that masks many of the idiosyncrasies in growth between provinces during this period of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so we look at, for instance, by industry here on the tourism, and that this devastation caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as the lockdown on the tourism industry, is a negative 70% drop off between 2019 and 2020 in terms of number tourists entering South Africa. And of course, the lockdown and the travel restrictions imposed has had a negative impact on all provinces involved. Here we just have the national picture. The graph here shows the latest figures of the unemployment rates by province, but again, we expect that even though that following the aggregate figure of unemployment increasing, that all provinces are pretty much also following suit in that sense. Thus, in chapter two, moving into the actual contents of the annual submission, chapter two, we're measuring the macroeconomic and fiscal impacts of COVID-19 in South Africa. We note that the COVID-19 pandemic and the imposition of the nationwide lockdown trigger the most significant recession in South Africa's economic history. Inefficiency in public sector service provision combined with the pandemic shock on overall productivity led to this highest levels of unemployment, poverty, and inequality that we've experienced. Supply and productivity side were adversely affected through mass unemployment and deficiencies in total factor productivity growth. On the demand side, as shown in this particular graph, shocks to consumption and investments in 2020 quarter two contributed to also that fall in aggregate demand. So both supply side and demand side indicators have deteriorated substantially during this period. Depletions, especially in inventory stocks and a lack of this import, undermines a swift prospect for swift growth recovery in the short term, as well as the long term.
Apologies, Mr. Lubabalo. Apologies, Shepherdson, through you. I understand that the presentation is not visible on our guest. I don't know if we can sort that, Mr. Sang, or if you are... Okay, I was going to suggest that I can run it from this side. I'm sorry about that, Chairperson. Over to you, Mr. Sang. I'm sorry about, for interrupting you.
Not at all. Thank you, host. Okay, is it visible now?
Yes.
Oh, thank you very much. Apologies, I think there was a bit of a technical confusion there. So as I was saying, honorable chair members, so both the demand side as well as supply side indicators show this tremendous drop in terms of activities, and that the depletion in the inventory stock as well as the long term sort of growth momentum as can be perhaps predicted by the public investment, both private and public, have also deteriorated, which suggests that both in the short term and the long term, the sort of the swift recovery, economic growth story is may seem rather unlikely. In the annual submission, we also examined the financial stability, shows that the producer price rose as a result of lockdowns, adversely affecting consumer purchasing power. For people, higher consumer prices, especially for core items, affected affordability of goods for poorer households. In this graph on the slide, as a result of the constrained economic and therefore fiscal space of the primary balance deteriorated even further with the onset of COVID-19. So the fiscal impulse has been compelled towards a consolidatory stance at the end of 2020. In terms of revenue, we see that an increase in this concentration and dependence on personal income tax, PIT, and value-added tax, which is not shown here, but it is in the annual submission. And most importantly, our research shows that fiscal leakages undermine any positive spillover effects that economic growth has on reducing public debt burden. So basically, no matter how much we are at a stage where no matter how much money that we throw at the problem in stimulating the economy with the amounts of fiscal leakages that is in the system, the economy will simply not grow despite the COVID-19. We, the Commission, therefore, makes the following recommendations based on the evidence researched. First, we need an alignment of the economic reconstruction and recovery plan across three spheres of government, especially between provincial and national committees in this 2022-23 division of revenue. Secondly, we reiterate our recommendation from last year to localize product value chain and procurement for inclusive growth and job growth. And third, we encourage the provinces and Minister of Finance to eliminate these fiscal leakages that is in the system. Again, it's better currently where it stands. As shown by the research that we've done, is that really there's no, money is not the problem at this stage in terms of recovering or stimulating the economy. Rather, it is about how we do things and how we spend money. In chapter three, we looked at the measuring the effectiveness of government expenditure on performance. So we looked at the following. Fiscal multiplier effects in relation to economic growth and social development, alignment and effectiveness government's performance indicators in representing their mandates and purposes, then the size and shape of the wage bill is examined, followed by the program and performance-based budgeting in relation to the efficiency and effectiveness of government expenditure. On the fiscal multiplier effects, that is essentially one rand in, how much out question of the economy, we find at the most ambiguous outcomes in the multiplier effect in small magnitudes. That is incredibly uncertain. So in other words, one year we would find a multiplier of positive 20, and then the other year we will find a negative, meaning that one rand in we actually get negative outcomes. That is affecting or impacting growth and other socioeconomic indicators such as poverty and unemployment. On the KPIs, we find no shortages of KPIs, but with persistent variances due to lack of accountability. On the wage bill, the result shows that it is larger than any other international comparators, which will be shown in the next slide. And lastly, the spending efficiency of the government through research suggests that 80% efficiency rates, that may look like a good score, but 80 cents on a rand should not be celebrated without asking where did the 20 cents go. This slide then just confirms the earlier points about the wage bill being significantly higher and then our international comparators, even by both by developing as well as developed or advanced economy standards. With these research results, the Commission recommends the Minister as the custodian of the national resources to enhance the consistency and coherency of the department's KPIs to the financial commitments of their budget via the MTEF, the Medium-Term Expenditure Framework Technical Guidelines, and seek to incentivize as opposed to resorting to this departments and entities and agencies resorting to their business as usual KPIs, simply reporting on progress as it has always been. Second, the public sector wage bill across all spheres of government should be reviewed to reduce. And last, we recommend the Minister of Finance to pay attention to the movement in the multiplier effect of expenditure as the economic environment is still changing due to the pandemic. So with that, may I just pass over to Sianda to take you through the next few slides.
Thank you, Chen, and good morning, honorable members. I am going to take you through chapter 4, 5, 7, and 8. So with chapter next slide, Chen. With chapter four looks at the impact of COVID-19 pandemic on the local economy. We know that the pandemic has exposed many gaps and inadequacies in the local government fiscal framework. We also know that the local government was already in a precarious situation even before the pandemic. So the pandemic exacerbated the challenges of local government, with many municipalities being unable to fulfill their constitutional mandates. This chapter therefore asks two questions. What is the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on local government fiscal framework? How can the local government fiscal framework be repositioned to turn around the local economy? Next slide. On this slide, we look at the impact of COVID-19 on municipal expenditure. We know that as at the end of December 2020, the local government had already spent about 20 billion on COVID-related expenditure. The COVID-19 pandemic simply pushed the expenditures of local government upwards, of the local government sector upwards. But as you look at the numbers, out of these expenditures, 64% of these expenditures was accounted for by metro municipalities. But this is not surprising given that metro municipalities account for almost 40% of the population. But overall, you see that there was a spending growth in all municipal categories, which owes itself to the pandemic. Next slide. We also looked at the impact of the pandemic on municipal owned revenue. This is a key indicator which shows that the pandemic had a devastating impact on municipalities. So COVID-related revenue pressures can be seen in the figure on the right-hand side. It shows how COVID had an impact on own revenues. So when you look at the green bar, which shows before and after COVID-19, the revenues received a hard knock across all municipal categories. But we see that in the metros and B1 municipalities represent large towns or cities, or what is normally called secondary cities. There was a rebound in the second quarter, which shows that these municipalities are resilient, and they owe this resilience to their diversified nature of their revenue base. While when you look at the other small municipalities, especially when you look in rural municipalities, they have continued to suffer the consequences of the pandemic. We see that that their own revenue continued to decline. Next slide, please. In this slide, we look at another crucial variable on municipal consumer debt. We see that many municipal revenues were affected, and that various consumers, that is households, businesses, and even government, were not able to pay what they owe to municipalities. And we see that the flow of revenue to municipalities was lacking. And as a result, many municipalities defaulted on their payments to creditors. The figures that you see on the screen show the number of municipalities owing Eskom increased rapidly. And even when you look at those that owe water boards, they also increased. For example, when you look at Eskom, municipalities failing to make payments, and which greater than 40%, they owe Eskom greater than 40% of their operating expenditure, increased from 34 in March, that is before the pandemic, to 50 during the pandemic. So this is a large increase, and it indicates that many municipalities were indebted to their creditors. And we can attribute this lack of this to the lack of finances from consumers, and this led to municipalities defaulting on their payments. So this gives quite a clear picture of the connection between consumers paying municipal accounts and the municipalities being able to pay their creditors. Next slide, please. In this slide, we try to mention some issues which we think should be done in the local government sector. I think one of the issues that municipalities need to move away from their traditional way of doing things and start promoting local economic development in their own spaces. This is not a new idea. There is also a need for municipalities not to look at national or provincial government, but in their own spaces also try to attract investment by prioritizing options with little or no price tags. We mentioned some of the areas that they can look at, such as streamlining red tape, reducing the amount of time it takes to obtain permits and licenses, reducing compliance, the compliance burden to their regulations. This has the potential to attract, if they are done correctly, all these have the potential to attract investment. Secondly, we show that there is a need to enhance, as we've mentioned, to enhance their revenue, their own revenue. I think the slide before showed that in municipalities which have a diversified revenue stream, they were able to take the shock and continue. So we say, and we've made this submission before, that they should explore additional revenue streams. As I mentioned that in our previous submission, we had recommended a number of alternative revenues to municipalities which they can then explore. So we're saying there's a need to diversify revenue, especially now that the COVID shock showed that municipalities with no diversified revenues were hit hard. Next slide. So in terms of this slide, we look at the recommendations from this chapter. And the first recommendation is that there is a need for municipality to undertake a detailed analysis of the services they provide and align these services with their financial capabilities. The Department of COCTA, Provincial Treasuries and SALGA should ensure that organograms, staffing levels and compensation levels are not set at levels that crowd out service delivery. Some of these staffing levels that you see in municipalities are too large for municipalities and they end up crowding out service delivery. So we say COCTA and SALGA should ensure that municipality, which is another recommendation that we make, should ensure that municipalities pass credible budget. This has been a challenge that municipalities are not approving credible budget and which then makes it difficult to implement the budget that they approve. Secondly, we recommend that municipalities should stimulate local economic growth by creating investment-friendly conditions, as already mentioned. Municipalities should consider additional revenue strategies, and as I mentioned already, that we have already made some recommendation in this regard. Lastly, we say National Treasury, through the Municipal Improvement Systems Grant, should support municipalities to embrace e-government and digitization and also support them to diversify their revenue. We saw that during this time where it was difficult to interact with people, things such as e-government and digitization have helped with some revenue. Next slide, Chen. So in this chapter, which is chapter 5, we look at addressing gender inequality through gender budgeting in the public sector. Next slide. So I think as we're all aware, and I think the chairperson has already alluded to this when she was doing her opening remarks, women bear a disproportionate burden of the triple challenges in South Africa. And we've seen that during this COVID time, that has intensified, and the issue of gender inequality has intensified, including gender-based violence. We know that on the other side, that the government has committed itself to promoting gender equality, and it is a signatory to many international treaties on this issue. And also locally, the government has come up with a number of legislative prescripts and policies to promote gender equality. But when you look on the ground, you see that gender inequalities still persist and they remain high. So here the FFC looks at the budget as an instrument which can be used to promote gender equality. And we look at where are the challenges and the constraints. So here we are not advocating that women should have a separate budget, but we are trying to say that in all spheres, gender budgeting must be mainstream to promote gender equality. Here in this chapter, we assessed the budgets of a number of key departments which we think have a potential to promote promote gender equality and gender mainstreaming. We looked at the Department of Basic Education, Health, Women, Persons with Disability, and Women and Persons with Disability, Justice, and the Commission for Gender Equality. So these, we said earlier, that these government departments are key in promoting gender equality, and if their budgets can be sensitive to gender issues, we can then go a long way. Next slide. So here we go straight to the findings, and I think we make the first finding that there is a limited mainstreaming of gender issues, which I've already alluded to it. And then I think I'll go to the one, because I've spoken about this one, that there's limited gender disaggregated type data. So as you look at the budgets of and information we could find in other domains within the within departments, you see that most of the data that is available is not gender disaggregated. You see that even maybe when you look at the Department of Education, when they say they've provided bursaries to students, you hardly find out that how many women actually received this, or how many girl children actually received these bursaries. So we make a recommendation that there is a need for gender disaggregated data. Next slide. So also this, in terms of that, whenever also these, because when we look at the commission, that is the gender commission, we see that it has a lot of statistics on gender issues, but these are rarely used. And even when you look at the performance indicators of departments, they lack detailed gender-specific department indicators. And even in the reports, they don't report about gender issues. So we are continuing with that to say there is a need to make sure that we report and we develop indicators which relate to women. Next slide. In this slide, we look at the recommendations coming from this chapter. First, we say there is a need for the Department of Women and Persons with Disability and the Department of Performance and Monitoring to finalize the institutionalization of gender-responsive budget, monitoring, and evaluation and auditing frameworks. There is a need to finalize and make sure that these frameworks are institutionalized. We also recommend that National Treasury and the Department of Women and Persons with Disability should spearhead the mainstreaming of gender-responsive budgeting across the entire scope of the budgeting process, whether it's national, provincial, or local. We also make the recommendation that National Treasury should create an enabling environment to institutionalize this gender-responsive budgeting. And then part of the recommendations, the Department of Women and Children should also spearhead initiatives for capacity building and understanding the gender budgeting as an important instrument which can transform society and ensure that there is gender equality. Lastly, the last one, yeah, thanks. Lastly, the Department of Youth, Women and Persons with Disability should on an annual basis prepare a report on how the division of revenue is responding to gender inequality. We believe that doing so will help institutions such as Parliament to be able to effectively exercise oversight on budget for inclusiveness and the promotion of gender equality. Lastly, Statistics South Africa and the Department of Women should provide explicit guidelines to collecting gender disaggregated data. This is to ensure that we address the gap that we identified on gender the lack of gender disaggregated data. I'll come back in the next chapter after Chen.
Thank you, Honorable Chairman. In Chapter 6 on testing the means tester, we look at the social assistance in South Africa in this COVID-19. We note that almost all our social grants in the country at the moment rely on a relatively simple means test as a targeting mechanism to determine eligibility and coverage. To an extent, though, the negative impact of COVID-19 has necessitated a reconsideration of the poverty and vulnerability for which these social assistance are designed. As previously non-poor South Africans experienced this severe income shock caused by the COVID or a permanent loss of livelihood, as earlier our chairperson has explained. It is thus important to understand how well the existing grant system covers vulnerable South Africans, and whether the current means testing approach ensures that the poorest receiving grants with no significant leakages to those who are ineligible or who shouldn't be getting. Furthermore, it is important to understand how the grant system was temporarily adjusted to reach those impacted by the pandemic, as well as how well targeted this effort has been. So this slide thus shows the coverage among job losers using the rapid mobile surveys, and suggests some key findings. First, the grant system is progressive, as it's always been. Second, the possibility of exclusion of poor individuals is low. And third, 80% of those who lost their jobs in 2020 lived in a household where some form of social assistance was received, and thus an alternative targeting mechanism, as many would perhaps start considering, may not be needed at the end of the day. Hence, the Commission recommends that the efficacy of the social grant system continues to be monitored. On eligibility, we should find out reasons for inadvertent exclusion of eligible grant recipients. Third, one could consider instead of currently income-based, but also an asset-based system of means tests to minimize leakages. And fourth, on the basic income grants, the government will have to consider its fiscal and socio-economic implications over the long term, and perhaps even intergenerational impact of such a grant in perpetuity. Let me hand over back to Sienna, please.
Thank you once again, Chen. So chapter 7, this chapter is concerned with the question of food security. Next slide. The impact of COVID on food, it looks at the impact of COVID on food security. The issue of food security is important for basic rights of individuals and society at large. We saw with the recent riots that happened. And I think we can all agree that the question of food was there. But we have seen that the government has tried by all means to beef up food security by providing food parcels during this time. Next slide. In this slide, I'll try and pinpoint the members to a few of the findings of this chapter. We all know that due to COVID, there was massive job losses, and what we try to understand what were the consequences of these job losses to food security. We see in this chapter that child hunger increased by 29%. That is the likelihood of a household running out of money for food purchase. We see that recurrence of household hunger also increased by about 8%. Also, we see that these are staggering statistics showing that food security was at risk during this time. But we also see that the old age grant and the COVID grant proved effective in protecting the household against welfare reversals as a result of COVID. Old age grant, as we may know, continues to be important in getting households through different shocks. When you take when you look at the old age grant in particular, it old age grant reduced the incidence of household food security by almost 60%, which is a phenomenal statistic. But if you look and put together the old age grant, the child grant, and the COVID grant, you see that all of them combined together reduced the incidence of food security by about 78%, which suggests there is a need to expand the scope of existing social protection mechanisms to reach those that are still not a part of them, to ensure that we there is food security and we mitigate the effects of poverty. Next slide. So in conclusion on this chapter, we note that the shock as a result of the pandemic resulted in substantial welfare losses in terms of the risks of food insecurity. We make the following recommendations, therefore. The department, we'll go to the last slide on recommendations. The Department of Social Development should involve local government and civil society organization to better collect data on unmet needs, to plan and better target those groups that still need assistance. This comes from the fact that we have seen that these grants actually mitigate and help families to get through the shock. So we also make the recommendation that the Department of Social Development should coordinate data on beneficiaries to create a database for government for those who are in need of social assistance. So having a data set that a database that can inform all government programs in terms of who needs social assistance, this will go a great way. We also make a recommendation that which relates to the two previous ones about expanding social assistance coverage to all vulnerable groups. We also make a recommendation that the National Treasury should consider incentives such as lifting value-added tax or duties when there is a shock such as this one, that is on specific items, so that we're able to mitigate the effects against food insecurity. And lastly, we recommend that the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries should use food reserves optimally to target those in need during this time of COVID. Next chapter. This chapter, which is chapter 8, looks at water and sanitation access, distribution efficiencies, and tariff setting in South Africa. So we look at, in this chapter, we look at the impact of COVID in accessing water. We also look at the distribution efficiencies and tariff settings in the sector. So those are the specific objectives of the chapter, and they are listed there. And I'll go to the findings straight, that one of our major findings is that when it came to access to water during the COVID pandemic, access decreased by 2%, which is huge considering that that's where this is the time when we needed water the most. And when you look at access to sanitation, almost 17% of households lacked access to sanitation. So you see that during this time, it was really COVID-19 had a bad impact on these two. On water distribution efficiencies, we see that there is a lot of inefficiencies across the system, such as water leakages. Our findings also show that water service providers could maintain the same output with 49% fewer inputs, which means that they could provide more water with the inputs they currently have. This means that there is a lot of inefficiencies in the system if they can provide more water with the inputs that they have. Some of these inefficiencies are driven by non-revenue provisions, which account for about 35% of the input of volume of water. The amount of water which is lost in the system is really a hindrance in the efficiency of the system. And when we look on the tariff side, the Commission argues that there is a need to be cautious in increasing tariffs during a pandemic because the poor could be harder hit if increases are not considered carefully, especially for things such as water and sanitation, which we consider basic commodities. Can move. Next slide. We also note that there is a need to involve the private sector in the provision of water. But we caution that private sector water provision can lead to water being inaccessible, especially for the poor. So municipalities can bring the private sector to invest in the infrastructure, but also at the same time try to guard against making water inaccessible for many people. We know that the government's money as it stands is not enough to cover the gap of water provision infrastructure, especially in this fiscally constrained environment. Can move to the next slide. The next slide. Yeah, thank you. So the recommendations we make in this chapter is that municipalities advised by SALCA should approach tariff adjustment cautiously, take into account the poor during a COVID crisis. And we say the Minister of Finance should ensure that water and sanitation projects form part of the stimulus package as they think about the stimulus package. So there's a need to include water and sanitation infrastructure infrastructure as part of the economic stimulus project by the government. The Minister of Finance will make a recommendation again that the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Water and Sanitation, together with municipalities, should develop strategies that de-risk private sector water investment when they bring private water providers or private sector to invest in the infrastructure. Thank you. I'll hand over to Sasha to continue the presentation.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee and other colleagues. If we can move to the next slide, please, Chair. So this chapter focuses on the system of intergovernmental oversight and support provided by national and provincial governments to municipalities. And what we looked at or wanted to check is to what extent the system of oversight and support can help to avoid Section 139 interventions. Now, the full pipeline of oversight and support, it starts with regulations that municipalities need to comply with. It's then followed with oversight conducted by national and provincial governments to ensure compliance, but also to pick up any challenges that can be mitigated. And then based on anything that is picked up during this oversight phase, we then have the support or capacity building function, whereby whatever is picked up, the national or provincial governments then assist municipalities in fixing. Now, in the case where these challenges are not sorted out and we see breakdowns in operations and service delivery, the final phase is intervention by a national or provincial government in the affairs of a municipality, and this is via Section 139 of the Constitution. So our concern is that the persistence of Section 139 interventions raises questions around the effectiveness of the oversight and support framework and whether it adds value in terms of acting as an early warning system that actually allows us to identify municipalities facing the potential threat of intervention. Moving to the next slide, please. So there are quite a few findings that emanate from our analysis, and I'll pick on a few. The first there is relates to whether we should view the role played by national and provincial governments in municipalities through the lens of oversight or supervision. And the terms that we use are very important. Supervision implies a more hierarchical type of relationship with national and provincial spheres acting as a sort of big brother in relation to municipalities. On the other hand, and for the FFC, we prefer the term oversight, which embraces the autonomy of each sphere and requires the spheres to cooperate and work together to solve challenges. Now, the second finding there, we know that support provided to municipalities can be both financial and non-financial. So capacity building grants are a type of financial support. And because in our research we looked specifically at the issue of financial management, we looked at the financial management grant in more detail. And our assessment is that whilst this grant is critical in the sense that it provides much needed funding to support the building and strengthening of financial management capacity, we think that there's definitely space for this conditional grant to be more tightly linked to that overall oversight and support system. We also found that there is general acceptance that new legislation and regulations have a cost attached to compliance. We know that. But we think that what is not generally acknowledged is that the cost associated with complying with monitoring requirements and support initiatives are not fully comprehended. So, for example, we have legislative monitoring requirements such as your Section 71 reports. Then you have ad hoc or non-legislative monitoring requirements. Municipalities spend time, effort, and money in complying with these aspects, but there's little to no concomitant benefit from the use of these resources. So we really think that there must be a very thorough interrogation of what the costs and benefits are when implementing new types of regulations. Then with respect to differentiation, the local government sphere we know has to comply with a significant amount of regulations. And the concern is that some of these regulations take a very uniform approach whereby all municipalities have to comply irrespective of their financial and human capital capacity to do so. And this results in a situation whereby some municipalities who are just unable to comply are then continuously penalized for this because adherence or compliance becomes a measure of performance. So we think that there must be some recognition of the varying capacities of municipalities. Then if we just look at the last finding there on legislative prescripts, we know that government departments operate according to their legal mandates. And what we found is that some key legislations can be fueling duplication when it comes to oversight and support. So, for example, you've got the municipal, sorry, Jen, it's Yeah, that's right. So you've got the Municipal Finance Management Act, the Municipal Systems Act, as well as various other sector-specific legislation that all speak to the same thing. So, for example, all those pieces of legislation that I mentioned all speak to how to set tariffs. So there's significant overlap, and we find that municipalities have to comply with requests around reporting on by different sector departments, which creates an additional burden. So in terms of the recommendations, we we recognize and support the review of capacity building grants that the National Treasury is undertaking. In relation to what our study looked at, we would further advise that as part of this review, consideration be given to directing the two key financial management capacity building grants, the financial management grant and also the municipal systems improvement grant. We recommend that it be disproportionately allocated towards your lesser resourced and more rural municipalities, since those are the ones who especially struggle with finding resources to put in place solid financial management systems. We also call on the Minister of Cooperative Governance to implement mechanisms to ensure that evaluations of the impact of the entire oversight and support framework are undertaken. And we recommend that particular emphasis be placed on cost-benefit analysis, especially when new regulations, monitoring and support initiatives are being introduced. Further, that in relation to this cost-benefit analysis, that we do not only focus on the extent to which oversight and the support framework result in improved performance, such as, for example, an increase in the number of, say, funded budgets, but that these cost-benefit assessments also focus on the extent to which the oversight and support framework is efficient and effective in terms of the burden it places on municipalities. We also recommend that government reconsider the current uniform approach that is being used to implement the oversight and support framework, and that a differentiated approach that recognizes the varying capacities of municipalities be considered when requiring compliance with regulatory and oversight or reporting requirements. Finally, we also recommend that legislation that gives rise to duplication within the oversight and support framework be reviewed. Chen, sorry, your slide, you, next slide, please. So the next chapter has a specific focus on leadership, with the main thrust being that leadership is critical in the implementation of infrastructure projects. And in the context of COVID-19, we know that effective leadership is indispensable in helping us to respond to the pandemic. And these leadership requirements to respond to COVID-19 to the pandemic are similar to those that we need to accelerate just your routine service delivery, including the delivery of infrastructure, which is the subject of this chapter. So in order to better understand how governance and accountability is hindered or enhanced by leadership, this chapter used a case study approach. We looked at two catalytic housing projects, namely Duncan Village in the Eastern Cape and Greater Cornubia in KZN. And we also looked at a bulk water supply project in Giyani. Then to better hone in on accountability, we used irregular expenditure, the yardstick, and we looked at irregular expenditure within the Department of Human Settlements over the period 2014-15 to 2019-20. Moving to the next. Chen, I'm only on the second slide of that chapter at the moment. Findings. Yes. So our assessment on the implementation of the housing catalytic projects showed a number of interesting points. Firstly, we found that whilst there are approved business plans for these catalytic projects, they are often not properly costed. And that obviously makes it very difficult to get a true sense of the financing requirements. We also found a lack of intergovernmental coordination resulting from poor consultations amongst the various stakeholders involved in infrastructure in these infrastructure projects. There are numerous players in the implementation of catalytic housing projects. You have human settlements, roads and transport, water and sanitation, just to name but a few. And often these stakeholders can have differing priorities in terms of the infrastructure plans, but also their sources of funding. What we saw as well is that in some instances where municipalities lack capacity, the HDA had been tasked with implementation of these catalytic housing projects, and that had gives rise to tensions between the municipality and the housing development agency, with a number of municipalities that we interacted with indicating that they were not properly consulted on key decisions that were taken. Then our research also highlighted the issue of how political factions within political parties, as well as direct political interference, hampered or led to breaches in supply chain regulations, delays, as well as cost escalations. Then our case study on the Giani bulk water project showed similar challenges as those that came up when we looked at the housing catalytic projects. Key among them were poor political leadership and interference, which then had a knock-on effect in terms of not following proper supply chain regulations, cost escalations, and again, delays in completion. Next slide, please. So this slide summarizes what we found when we assessed the Auditor General's audit outcomes related to the Department of Human Settlements of the period 2014-15 to 2019-20. And as I mentioned earlier, we looked specifically at irregular expenditure. So irregular expenditure is expenditure that was not incurred in the manner prescribed by legislation. So it's an indicator of non-compliance that then needs to be investigated by management to determine whether it was an unintended error, whether it was negligence, or whether it was done with the intention to work against the requirements of legislation. And as you can see in that graphic, the significant acceleration of irregular expenditure from 88 million in 2014-15 to 3.1 billion in 2018-19 exemplifies the disregard for the findings by the Auditor General, and really just reflects the severe lack of consequence management. Moving to the recommendations, there are three recommendations that flow from this chapter. The first recommendation emphasizes the need to enforce compliance with legislation and policy frameworks when undertaking these infrastructure projects, and to ensure financial consequences for compliance in the event of compliance failures. The second recommendation then calls for improvements to the intergovernmental coordination policy framework. With these large infrastructure projects, we know there are many stakeholders working together, so we need that framework to be tightened to work well. And the last recommendation emphasizes the need to incentivize consequence management. Chair, that brings us to the end of our slide presentation. If I may please hand back to to Dr. Mbava, please. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Thank you. Over to you, Doc. Okay, you may come in, Doc.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. So that is the extent of our presentation. And we hand it over to you and to honorable members to deliberate and to consider all these recommendations.
Thank you very much, Doc, with your team FFC, very comprehensive report and a briefing on the effects or impact of the COVID-19. Very thankful for the presentation. As we're going to have the engagement of the members, the theme is the effects of COVID-19. And there's a number of recommendations that was presented for the committee to consider. And then now we have given an hour for the presentation so that we have an in-depth, detailed report and presentation. So now we will give them over to the members. Lubabala, do we have any hands from the members for engagement?
Thank you, we have two hands so far. Honorable Ryder.
Pardon, Honorable Ryder, in?
Honorable Ryder, Honorable Dudoit, Honorable Morlezane now.
Okay. Honorable Ryder, Honorable Dudoit, Honorable Molotan.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, we'll take it in that sequence. Honorable Ryder, come first.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation to the FLC. Always informative. And appreciate it. I do appreciate the input from the FLC. So first of all, to Dr. Mbava, congratulations on your appointment. We look forward to working with you and to learning from you and your colleagues. And we hope that you will fill the shoes that were left. They were quite big shoes. So good luck. We look forward to you stamping your own personal brand onto the FFC as well. So thank you very much and good luck. If we can just confirm before we actually get into the detail on the presentation, if the doctor can just tell us if there have been any other changes to the board members, if any of the other shuffles have happened, when it comes time to respond, I'd appreciate that. Good. Regarding the presentation, I think once again, useful inputs and much appreciated. Not quite as critical as the last lot that we had, but obviously I think that there's a general acceptance that we find ourselves in a situation we need to work our way out. And so constructive inputs are obviously preferred. The questions I have, the first one I want to point to is equitable share. Specifically looking at local government. And of course, the fact that we've had the effects of the downgrades, the situation where municipalities were struggling anyway, the downgrades have affected investments, certainly in some of the metros. So some international investments have kind of dried up from that point of view. Then, of course, along came COVID. And now we have had the insurrection that happened on the 11th, 12th, 13th July, etc. This has all had a compounding effect for local government because what has happened is that collection rates have dropped lower and lower. And the ability of consumers to pay their municipal accounts, not only the rates and taxes, but also the consumption accounts, is under tremendous pressure as income has dried up or reduced, as working hours have reduced, etc., etc. And this in turn is placing municipalities under extreme pressure. Now, we know that certain municipalities have also, certainly in the KwaZulu-Natal, given some businesses a little bit of leeway with their accounts based on the fallout from the rioting, from the insurrection, from whatever you want to call it, that has impacted their income streams as well. And of course, that again has a knock-on effect because factories that are closed because they were looted are also not paying wages to their staff because, you know, you get paid per hour, which then means the staff also can't pay their rates and taxes. So are you recommending any sort of adjustment in equitable share to kind of, you know, shore up local government finances against this? That's the first question. My second question relates to the term fiscal leakages. Now, we had it in last year's presentation as well, Mr. Chen, and I asked the question then, and I'm not sure that I got an adequate response, because I still get the feeling that when you say fiscal leakages, you're almost using code to talk about corruption. And I mean, you know, I've obviously had a look at Keynes's definition of leakages, and you know, it's you know, non-asset orientated expenditure and so on. But what are you really getting at? You use the broad term fiscal leakages. I want you to decode your code, please. So speak openly with us. We're all friends here. Well, most of us anyway. Good. The next thing that I wanted to point out was the issue around the LED. You focused quite strongly on the local economic development component of the local government's expenditure and so on. And of course, the fact is that the scariest words that any entrepreneur can hear are, hello, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Most entrepreneurs hear that and run a mile, because the reality is that government doesn't understand business historically and traditionally. And as soon as we try and intervene, it normally ends in tears. So the reality is that you know, local economic development is all good and well, but it needs to be done in concert with the focus on providing service delivery. In other words, the focus on actually providing the services and doing what local government is supposed to be doing. Now, until you're getting that right, focusing on LED is probably not the greatest idea. You know, I understand that it might be necessary. People are living with you anyway, living in your areas, working in your areas, and require development. But unless you're focusing on getting your electrical supply, your water supply, your roads, in order to get customers to shops, etc. You know, so I'm just wondering how you're seeing that role of LED playing out, and whether it's not a better idea to actually focus on the knitting, as it were, do your core constitutional obligations, and the local economic development should follow. You know, I understand often there is a need for some development, but development, you know, as I say, entrepreneurs invariably lead themselves. And I'm wondering if that's actually, you know, how many examples do you have of good local economic development projects that have actually worked? And perhaps that best practice needs to be investigated. And maybe that's a recommendation to the chair and the management team. Perhaps we can look at success stories of local economic development projects that have worked, and we can share those. And then, of course, the issue around credible budgets was the comment, and municipalities that need to pass credible budgets. Now, I'm aware that I think there were only two municipalities in Gauteng that passed funded budgets recently. The rest were all passing unfunded budgets. You know, it's called the Hail Mary budget. We're going to pray and hope that money comes from somewhere to fund what we're doing. Or alternatively, we're going to go backwards. Now, you know, understanding it's an election year and people are, you know, selling off their family silver to make sure that they can do some service delivery and so on. But it's not only this year that this has been the case. It's historically repeated. So my question then is how does the FFC see DORA being used to incentivize good spending, to incentivize good governance, to to incentivize good budgeting, to incentivize good procurement processes. Because realistically, you know, what we're sitting with at the moment is a situation where it doesn't matter on your performance or how you spend the money, you can be guaranteed to get money again next year. There's no consequences. Now, we keep speaking about consequence management, but does the FFC see, you know, any room to amend DORA slightly to either build in an incentive for good behavior or a disincentive? And I'm a fan always of incentives rather than punishment. I think positive reinforcement works generally better than anything else. But realistically, you know, there is no incentive other than, you know, a money badge for people to you know, implement good governance and good spending practice. Is there a way that that can be brought into DORA? Chair, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Ryder. Honourable Retoit.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Also want to congratulate Dr. Mbaba on her appointment. We wish you all the best for the great task that lies ahead, and I'm thanking the FFC for the presentation. Yes, it's staggering to see to which extent the amount of people that receive government grants has grown in the past year. And also the tourism sector that's got a negative 70% growth. We all knew that it was bad, but did we really realize what the effect of that was and is on the economy? What we must keep in mind is that we've got an increased debt service cost. And it's costing the country more to get debt at the end of the day. The presentations that was given to us by both the Land Bank as well as the Development Bank indicated that investors are not that eager to invest in South Africa anymore. Now, I'm taking a broad approach, but everything takes hands at the end of the day. With the unrest costing the country a lot of money, the impact is estimated at about 50 billion rand, the impact on the GDP. And then items that were not necessarily budgeted for, like the 350 rand social relief grant that has been extended, the SANDF deployment, the disaster relief for companies that were affected during this protest time. All of that is adding up, and yes, it's shifting around of budgets of different departments, but that's money that could have been spent more effectively to building the economy. National Treasury indicated that 44% of the unrest-affected businesses has closed down permanently. Between 9 and 19 July, the rand depreciated by 2.4% to the USD. That has an effect on imports and exports, and the economy at the end of the day, and the tax base in the country is shrinking, as our colleague mentioned just now. In your presentation, you focus on inequality that is a reality, but what we must look at is opening the economy for the economy to grow on itself. It's evident that legislative attempts have been unsuccessful to now and have in effect worsened the economic portion of millions and the economic position of millions of people in the country. So more measures to this respect will not necessarily turn around the current situation. The basic income grant is not sustainable. Yes, it's assisting a lot of people at this stage, not the basic income grant, that's 350 rand grant. But we cannot afford to go further and further into a country that just hands out grants. In the beginning of your presentation, as I alluded, we've got that huge percentage of people that's dependent on the state at this stage. And the government cannot afford to look after everyone by means of grants. We can't keep people dependent. My personal opinion is that the government is doing this to keep people dependent, to ensure that they voted in again. The findings that was mentioned with the increased hunger, increased child hunger, increased unemployment. I see it as self-induced by government as a result of these restrictive COVID regulations that was imposed in the country. Initially, when the COVID pandemic struck South Africa, the initial lockdown was in order to give the health system and the health sector ample time to prepare themselves for this. But after that, you can all agree that some of these regulations were absurd. And that just put the country in a more dire situation than we were in before COVID, because we were in a dire situation before that as a result of looting of the state coffers and state capture. We must see to it that the support that's given to municipalities must be monitored. Yes, more money is needed for municipalities, but at the moment there's no consequence management for the mismanagement of funds. In the findings that was presented to us, page 46, it refers to water and water availability. And it's mentioned here that less water during COVID-19, access to water decreased by 2%. I want to know how this can be, since government spent millions of rands in drilling of boreholes, tankering water to different settlements and areas, erecting water tanks at schools, etc. How can it be that we spent millions of rands but less people had access to this? I can go on, but let's first see what the responses are, and maybe, Chair, if it's allowed, and if it's needed, we can have a second bite. Thank you.
Can I continue, Chair? Thank you, Chairperson. Let me take it that you are allowing me to continue. Let me also join my colleagues to congratulate Dr. Patience for her new appointment. Let me apologize for not being on a video. I tried to switch it on, but I can realize that the network is a little bit weak where I am. Chairperson, due to COVID-19, most of the municipalities are failing to keep up with paying their creditors. Now, I just want to find out from the FFC, how best can they advise the local government in order to improve to collect their revenue? If they can maybe they can be able to say that which steps to follow in order to achieve to improve to collect their revenue. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Molasane. Those are the three engagements that we'll give our first round to the team FFC to respond on the first round. Am I audible, Babala?
Yes, I'm still busy
arranging myself, but I'm fine. Okay.
Okay. Yes, the president, but there are two extra hands that are on the platform. So I don't know whether you prefer to take them now or maybe you want to come back later to them.
Okay. Can you identify the names? Who are the two?
Honorable Karim and Honorable Luana.
No, I think let's finish this round. Let's give the two hands, Honorable Karim, and then Honorable Luana. Then we know it's the first round. Honorable Karim, yeah, okay, you're welcome.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I'll be very quick. Firstly, congratulations to the new chair, Dr. Mbava, and we wish you well. Now, you know, maybe because of the years I've been around, but I think you too, as a Commission recognize this. A lot of the things you say have been said before by yourselves and so many others, independent institutions, NGOs, other civil society structures, the government or various public entities themselves. So, you know, you can do what you do, which is set out in the Constitution, but the rest depends on us as Parliament and the executive and other relevant institutions. And of course, as I keep saying, each time there is a failure for the state to do what it's supposed to do, it's also a reflection on Parliament's failure to exercise our oversight properly. Yes, it's the ANC that's the majority party and therefore is primarily responsible for the state of the state and the state of society and democracy. But it does remain true that we as a committee, as Parliament as a whole, are also responsible for these failures, as indeed is civil society. We're all in this, even if the elected government is primarily responsible. For example, you know, you raised this matter of the LED now. Well, you know, there's Trevor Fowler here. I think he was the MEC then, I was chairing the committee when the white paper was adopted, Chairperson. I think you were in your nappies and you were but you've been a councillor and you know these issues too. So, you know, as far as I know, colleague, LED has been, well, let me think of a word that's kinder, not successful, a failure, more than just an orderly failure. Now, as Dennis rightly says, I mean, you know, well, before I come to what Dennis is, which I, you know, was going to raise anyway, is to say also, I think the prospects of LED are even slimmer now, due respect to the FSC. Obviously, this report was written before the unrest broke out. But with the unrest having happened, and I mentioned yesterday, by the way, so the FFC and addressing them, obviously, and maybe the MPLs who are here, that, look, man, you know, we were stunned yesterday. We knew these things about the consequences of the unrest. You know, 14,500 jobs at least gone, 89% of the businesses that have been destroyed, actually small businesses, 44% of them, 44% of which it was said, closed temporarily, and we don't know whether they'll actually come back to life or not, even if in a truncated form. So we're in a dire situation. Obviously, as FFC, you haven't had time, nor could you address it comprehensively here. The consequences, not just of COVID now, but also the social unrest, where we lost at least $50 billion in GDP. Of course, you know all these statistics, but that's the point Dennis is making. I say this because I also mentioned yesterday, here where I live, St. Lucie, we have said, as of other municipalities, I think, it's a greenish to understand, that, you know, because of the unrest and because of all these properties having burnt down, the rates, property rates, are obviously going to be much smaller in this financial year than would have been anticipated by the municipality in preparing its budget. They've also exempted municipalities from businesses from paying property rates so that have been affected, all of which is going to have a severe impact, obviously, on local government revenue. The municipalities alone can't be held responsible for the crisis that broke out. So as the FFC began to look at this issue, we come back to the famous issue that we first raised, remember, Trevor Fowler, about the fundamental premise being wrong, that municipalities will raise 95% of their own revenue. Yes, in the old system, maybe. In the new system, with expanded powers, and heaped upon it, as Dennis points out, unfunded mandates. I mean, how municipalities are going to be able to function effectively and fulfill the constitutional and legal mandate, if it is presupposed wrongly that they will secure 95% of their own revenue, which is not to say that we excuse municipalities, Chairperson, from the failures to manage their funds properly, from the looting and what have you. So I think on the Guiana project, this is a huge change, Chairperson, on the state, really, on government. It's a disaster from what you can see. I don't know what the latest would be. I'm not sure that I got enough of that from the FFC, and maybe things have moved on a bit, because I hear mutterings in the media that things are turning around. I don't know enough to your question. The relevant committee would know more. But the Gyanep project is something that really is very, very severe strain on the municipality, on the state as a whole. And it's been in the public domain for some while, not least with National Treasury raising it. Now, obviously, everybody's entitled to their own view, and people must express them. My own view is very different from the view that the state deliberately keeps people on social grounds so as to win votes. I mean, it's not really absurd state in my view, but people are entitled to that view. Now, firstly, the government itself, ever since Trevor Manuel was the minister, in his latter half of his tenure, was clear. At that stage, we weren't offering the social grants that we offer now. There were far more. And the drain on the fiscus is even huger. So, you know, nobody I know of in the state has said, yes, we should remain a nanny state. Yes, let people be on welfare. We looked at various options. I don't want to go on, but people might be interested to know. If casinos know about this, about the Brazilian option, where you use part of what you get as a grant to find self-employment and so on. We looked at various options. It's unsustainable, we all agree. But precisely because of the inequalities, and of course you've got to get economic growth, job-creating economic growth, get people off social benefits. Of course, everybody agrees, and not least the majority party. But in the meanwhile, while we have these grotesque inequalities, not to provide a basic income grant in the view of many people, both inside the majority party and outside, would be almost inhumane. Not almost inhumane, actually almost savage, actually, given the paucity of access to jobs and other resources that poor people have. We have grotesque inequalities. Only yesterday, it was said that 64.4%, if I've got it right, FFC, of young people between the ages of 15 and 25, I think, are unemployed. We got the worst, yesterday it was confirmed that one of the commentators was saying it, anyway, worst job difficulties. I think it's 44% now that are unemployed. Now, what are you going to get if not more and more social unrest? What are you going to get, Chairperson? So we need to address those issues. And the FFC might want to be more activistic in this regard while retaining its independence and operating within the constitutional mandate it's got. But we have to do something. Otherwise, what happened in July is only a flicker of what will happen a year from now and later as COVID begins to bite even more. And in fact, the social unrest begins to also do the same. So the FFC, obviously you will act within your constitutional and legal mandate. But you obviously presumably applying yourself to this. But the one thing that Dennis says is actually absolutely, because we are NCOP, one of our concerns is, equitable share. This is a committee that looks at that. And in fact, we're concerned about the concerns, if you like, about municipalities. So this formula thing that's dragging on that never gets resolved in any way. What has been the latest progress on that? And will you take into account the social unrest of July? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Karim. Honorable Wane.
Thank you, Chairperson. And, Chair, I must say up front that who Honorable Karim has taken part of the areas that I would have wanted to reflect on. In particular, the matter that talks largely to local government and the matter of equitable share, that has always been an issue. So I really would have wanted to hear that on the part of the FFC. Chair, there's a very interesting slide on chapter 10. Intergovernmental relations. studies that were presented that are clearly raising the tensions, in particular the example of the Dangan village and national housing program that is taking place there by HCA. Are issues that talks to issues of intergovernmental relations, where there is no much effort that is put in terms of the spheres that works and collaborate on the sphere of local government to ensure that they carry that sphere along in terms of the development that's taking place in that particular area. So those are some of the things. Additional to it, the issues of resources come to play as well. And of course, by and large, equity issues. So these are some of the things that also have a bearing if we are to have effective management and leadership insofar as delivering programs on the ground. The other important matter to check is the gender responsive budgeting. You know, as articulated there, you will immediately look at the ideal and the current, because some of this is driven by a certain values, or rather by certain values. So you move from a primus that talks to broader matters of equity, and also moving from the point of view that says our country is a society that is fraught with inequalities, inclusive of gender disparities. So you would then put a program that seeks to attract the very civil service that is aware or is made aware of those. And clearly, the programs that you would seek to put when you have absorbed them into the civil service would remain, have this ad hoc outlook, because you have people that have to, you know, to be taken into a process moving from one culture to another culture in terms of understanding this matter. So let me not prolong, but I just wanted comments on some of these areas. And the last one would be on the issue of social grants, which I would say has SFC not looked at social grants vis-a-vis sustainable programs, because all of us agree that they are not sustainable. But then social grants outside the a program like your Vukuzenzele kind of a program would remain unsustainable. But also, if we are to build a country independent of social grants without phasing in these kinds of programs, that must be driven at a central level and deliberately pushed so that you take our people away from that dependency, which is caused by these realities in our society. I just want to tell you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Luana. Yes, a lot has been engaged with the presentation that was presented to the committee. And then when I'm going to give over to Team FFC, Doc, with your team, I just gonna want one highlight, just to make highlights on, I think, emphasis that was made by the engagement from the members, emphasis around the equitable share, the fiscal leakages, the local economic development, debt service cost, inequality, international relations, local government, creditors. Yeah, just to give highlights on the points which I think was emphasized, but there's a lot was been said, which was captured by yourself, which we will then give over to you, Team FFC, to respond. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Doc.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson, and to the members for this extensive feedback. We really appreciate that you engage with the subject matter. I want to give the first response to Professor Fowler. I think he's most suitable to speak about the local government aspects, since he's got that extensive experience there. And then on the issues that are very technical, for instance, the fiscal leakages, the explaining thereof, and also maybe both of them can also speak to that, the LED as well. I'll ask my team, the head of research, to speak to that. Chairperson, the issues on unfunded budgets and funded budgets, I think we'll address that as well. We appreciate as well the extensive feedback and the, you know, the comments that Mr. Karim has presented, as well as Mr. Dutoit. But I think now I want to hand over to if he's available, to Professor Fowler, to just ventilate his insights and what he thinks on the honorable members' deliberations on local government issues.
Thank you, Dr. Mbaba, Chairperson.
Thank you.
On the question asked by Honorable Ryder about the local government equitable share. I think Honorable Karim also asked a question about local government equitable share, that the real challenge around the local government equitable share is not so much the formula between the provinces and municipalities, but in fact, the vertical distribution. Local government only receives 9% of the total amount of funds that are distributed by government. And noting that there are 278 municipalities, and the point that Honorable Karim was making, that in the white paper of 1998, it was assumed that municipalities would raise most of their funds, but in reality, we know that situation is not correct. So I think it's one of the areas that perhaps the committee can start taking up with the National Treasury to say, if you want to address this problem, you need to look at improving the amount that local government gets. So that would be my first. The second issue that I wanted to address was this question about the local economic development. In reality, the core business of a municipality is really about providing services, and most of the services that municipalities provide are really related to infrastructure. So if municipalities are addressing their infrastructure, the infrastructure will result in economic development. So there are two things that need to happen. One is providing the basic infrastructure, but there's also infrastructure that is required for economic development that is related to access, roads, etc. And has to be directed in concert with where you expect investment to happen. And in some of the, in most municipalities, unfortunately, even the metros, the economic development and where infrastructure goes is driven by, you know, by developments. And that doesn't necessarily happen in the most equitable way. And I think that's an area that we really need to, that needs to be addressed by municipalities as a whole. The improvement on collections, whether or not we can address that. The key challenge that municipalities face at the moment is in fact this reduction that has extended beyond the period of the first restrictions that has continued. And that, unfortunately, is going to have, they're going to result in municipalities having to make very difficult decisions between what kind of services they can provide at the level that they were doing previously and what services are crucial to one, to human, a better life for people, or human existence. The second is really about how they address it to ensure that economic development. And I think that's a big challenge that municipalities have, is making that that balance. And that, that's something that occurs, is going to occur differently in each municipality depending on their circumstances. The question about social grants, in reality, the current grant that is being given, the 350 Rand, is not just, you know, a giveaway. In fact, it is vital for the continued survival of those families and the continued survival of food security, et cetera. And I think that's the basis of that that grant. Whether or not I wouldn't want us to want the FFC to at this point venture into the question of whether it should be sustained beyond the COVID, because that's not something that we've looked at carefully and made recommendations on. If there are any others, I could we could address them later. But I think that that will cover many of the questions that have been asked. My colleagues will address some of the others. Thank you.
Thank you. Chen will answer the rest of the questions.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you again, honourable members, for the questions, and through you, Chair. So they need, if you allow it, go in detail of some of the rest of the questions and one by one in that order of question. So first is already explained by Commissioner Professor Fowler is regarding the equitable share. Honourable members and Chair, I think you'll remember that for many a times, former Chair Professor Daniel Blackies has already said that the equitable share formula discussion is in fact the wrong discussion, or it's the wrong debate. And it precisely is because, as Commissioner Fowler really quite clearly said, that there is, we have to differentiate between the horizontal division, which is the between local municipalities, or if you like, provinces, if it's the provincial equitable share. Before that, the very critical points of decision and steps taken in terms of division of revenue is that vertical division. So after that 9%, as Commissioner Fowler said, then it's up to the formula to debate it out how much and or what how the formula decides horizontally. So we see as commission and through research evidence is that no matter how or what's the debate, how heated the debate is in the horizontal division, we will still not get away with the 9% vertical division of revenue. So that's how it makes it into the wrong debate to have. So yes, we think as Commission, we do see the need to adjust, that there is adjustments needed for that. And also, but starting to affect that adjustment properly and effectively is to actually differentiate between these two types of division in order to make the correct, to direct the debate going forward correct in the right way. And that also relates to, of course, the 90%. Honorable Karim is absolutely right. The 90% on revenue assumption is old and it's out of date and it's the wrong assumption. To have, we have 257 local municipalities. Some municipalities have more cattle than there are human beings or rate payers. So in essence, it really speaks to the point of that that one size fits all error, which we may that perhaps through this assumption. I shall come back to further to that. Going to the fiscal leakages, Radha, you're right. I think there is a need to expand the definition of what a fiscal leakage is. Yes, around 2 years ago, I think it was, a former minister said that, or in his speech, he talked about fiscal leakage, but in the sense, insofar as just corruption or money being stolen. But actually, fiscal leakage in the literature, it can also mean, which I would like to adopt more from a literary point of view, is this liquid redundancy in liquidity. So in other words, just money just keeps flowing without giving value. Remember, at the end of the day, cash and money is just a medium of exchange. If it doesn't generate value, right, that's all leakage, that's all wasted. So if you perhaps take a more of an accountant's or auditor general's perspective, it's more about that wasteful and fruitless expenditure that's a problem than more than irregularity. And in the same vein, as we expand the definition or understanding of this fiscal leakage, things such as like a cost of borrowing is also a form of leakage, because in essence, it's just, you know, things that we pay, but just for the sake of liquidity, that is not yet creating value. Same as well can be applied to say maybe like all this cost to investigate corruption, and also this in essence, we all, if we look at some of the investigations and all of these current commissions looking into, you know, procurements, irregularities, and so forth, it's all catching years after, right? Sort of looking 3 years later, what happened, and then how much money we can get back, but actually it will never, you know, be equal to the money wasted in that sense. So what are the sort of the technical indicators that one may look at? I would say follow the money. As when we talk about fiscal leakages, follow the money. Where do the money sit that is supposed to have been used or allocated for a particular purpose, but not bringing real, the sort of the real impacts, meaning the real returns on those, the cash purpose that it was meant to be doing. Moving on to the LED and also other sort of local development issues, ultimately, I think there is a need to shift the focus from sort of the LED, or as macroeconomists may say, even this thing of localized product value chain or green economy, to just base to back to the constitutional mandates. The service, the basic services, because without things like water, electricity, refuse, sanitation, if you combine the refuse and water, there's no economic development possible, whether it be at local level, MISO level, or national level, really, or macro level. So in essence, we think that, as commissioned, I think, through research and also many years of how to bring about local development or local economic development, we see that all those things are actually impossible if we don't get those basic services and infrastructures in place and rights. And similarly, in that sense, earlier also Honorable Meletsane asked how best to get local government to collect revenue. Well, local government can't collect revenue if there's no service provided. I think that is a major challenge in that sense, is that, I mean, no one would want to pay for a service if the service doesn't exist or isn't provided in the first place. And then moving to the one more point about the cost of debt, as Honorable Du Bois asked, I think it's important to bring in one fact, and it's an international fact, also it's a bond market fact, is that South Africa, we say our debt to GDP ratio is at about 80%. Our cost of financing as a percentage of GDP is at 4%. This compares to, say, the UK, which has got an excess recently over 100% debt to GDP, but only at 1% of cost of financing. Now, then one may ask, why the difference? And the difference there is because it's the risk premium. It's the risk premium that that investors deem that South Africa is so much riskier to invest in. And that they're not willing to, unless of course we basically incentivize them, saying, look, we will pay you a bit more. We'll pay you a bit more in terms of borrowing your money, and we will pay you back more. Otherwise, they wouldn't want to lend to us. And that is what that difference is. So it really shows the weakening position of our fiscal framework and our fiscal standing. And especially going forward, I mean, we are looking already at debt redemption at almost 20% of our budget going forward, meaning that before, say, the next budget comes in, 20% of that money must just go and pay off the cost of servicing before we even think about maybe how much to go into education and health and all the other social services that are needed. One more thing about moving to consequence management, Honourable Chair members, I just want to, we would like to just point out that this term of consequence management has been thrown around quite many times, as also Honourable Karim has said. Remember that our powers as a commission really depends, as you're right, on the essentially this parliament's power and resolve to bring the executive to account. And just a caution there is that as we perhaps the parliament and also advised by the FFC, we are deepening that need and that notion of consequence management. There is a lot of also this shift to, and obviously by those who are supposed to be to be brought to account, to shift the responsibility down. To trickle that down responsibility. So that is already starting to happen, I think, especially in the procurement sector, where you see that all these blames and all this consequence management and sort of shifting downward into the organization or into the department. That may also essentially, then what's the problem with that? Is that ultimately your consequence management is the impact is not, didn't start off from the very top, which is what it's supposed to be before it's just essentially diluting the responsibility, if you like. Lastly, on the social grants, I think the issue is not about as much, I say, about sustainability of this grant. I think it's about more about the incentive. What is the incentive effect of the grant? And I think over the past decades, right, of the grant system, and also in literature, in the history, in the historical facts, is that jobs could be more incentivizing than these grants of little amounts like 350 or other amounts that one government is able to afford or not afford, really. So I think at the end of the day, it's about what is the sort of the economic trajectory that South Africa is looking at. Is it just looking at solving the current issue through these grants, or one may want to think more in terms of long-term, more incentivizing system or the economic growth path of that job creation and growth. And by the way, a job is also much more retainable in the sense that even if you get fired, for example, from one job, at least you can move on to that you retain perhaps some of that skills, the job skills that you carry with as an individual to create more job opportunities, for instance, or to work more and generate income in that sense. Chair, I leave it there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson. I hope those questions were sufficient to answer all the questions.
Chair, if I could say something.
Yes, Commissioner Mukhadi.
Yes, right. I just want to take up on one question by Honorable Moletsane. And I think Chen has responded to it well by saying that there's no way that we can expect municipalities to attract revenue or retain it unless they provide services. But over and above that, the FFC has gone further than just to state the obvious, which is what had been said already. And it is in Chapter 4 where we were very specific. I think Sasha went through that to say that several steps that can be taken by municipalities in attracting revenue include, for example, diversification in the approach of revenue enhancement and streamlining to avoid red tape, for example, the turnaround time it takes to obtain licenses and permits, etc., and as well as e-government. In the light of the pandemic, we've realized that one way of improving communications between municipalities and the residents, it's through digitization and e-learning and e-platforms. So if these could be utilized, that could really facilitate the processes by which municipalities could go very far in terms of revenue collection. And of course, linked to this is the issue of leadership that was covered in Chapter 10. I think this is where the oversight committees such as the NCOP can assist us here, of political interference where it occurs. We've given two examples where there are witnesses with regard to that part of our political interference or lack of proper leadership. And it is to enhance and enforce and really do a proper to provide support at that level so that projects, infrastructural projects that are needed to assist municipalities in terms of service provision and attracting revenue are not hampered by that lack of leadership. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Mukhadi. I'm not sure if there are other responses from our team.
Yes, there's just a question about what drove water access to decrease by 2%. So to understand water access, we used data from the National Income Dynamics Study, the Coronavirus Rapid Mobile Survey, which collected data at different points during the nationwide lockdown. And the key reason that drove the decrease, as we look at the data, it is the change in employment status, which led to which affected household income and also affected affordability. So that is the key reason, as we look at the data, that drove the decrease in access to water by 2%.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. I would like to give to Commissioner Fowler, if there are any closing comments he has.
Thank you, Chair. I was going to answer the same question around the 2%. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much. Over to you, Honourable Chairperson of the NCOP. Those are our responses. So we await any further comments.
Okay, excuse me, it's Eunice. Mr. Njadu, are you back? If not, Comrade Mamarakhane is chairing this meeting, as I understand it. Comrade Mamarakhane, can you please take over? Thank you. Sorry, I'm not sure what's going on. Lubabalo, can you please help with Comrade Mamarakhane? She's meant to be chairing. Okay, while you're trying
Hello, Chair.
Yeah,
yes. Chairperson, I believe Honorable Njadu is back. I've just accepted
good.
Him now.
Okay.
Honorable Njadu, are you back in the meeting?
Yes, I'm back.
Okay, thank you very much. Just to explain, Secretary and outsiders, Comrade Njadu, the agreement between the chairperson of SECOA and myself is that where we have an acting chair, if the acting chair falls away for the reasons that happened to you, as a last resort, particularly should chair SECOF meeting, then I should chair SECOA meeting. Because we're very experienced. And look, I'm 65 now. How long am I going to be? And I'm here by accident anyway. So the younger people must take over and the newer members. So Mamarakhane should be on standby, Comrade Njadu, in case you fall away. If she falls away as well, obviously I'll chair. Thank you. Just to explain. Okay.
Okay. No, thank you. Thank you, Honorable Karim. Thank you for the assistance. Thank you. I think where we are now is that we received a response from Team FFC. And I think that it's where we are on the meeting. And then can we just check whether is there anything from Team FFC that you maybe think that you have left that you would want to maybe to emphasize on doc before we give a second round to the members to engage further? Can we just double check on the team, doc?
Yeah, my team, if anyone, Commissioner Fowler, Commissioner Mukhadi, and the Head of Research, if there are any further comments, please, by all means, do comment. Otherwise, we can hand over back to the committee.
I think we can hand that.
If Nando...
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Doc. Thank you very much. Members, back to the members. Are there any further engagements from the members? Lubabalo, any further hands?
Chairperson, the only hand that I see is Honorable Karim's hand, and I suspect it's an old hand, unless I'm making a mistake.
Can I just comment? Yeah, you're right, it is an old hand, and I am in fact an old hand, so to speak, which is the point I was making earlier. But, you know, now that we are where we are, and we have a bit of time, it's not just to consume the time, but if there were two other questions I had, they were eclipsed in a way by other things that were said. But one of the things we've had, and as Parliament, we have alerted the DG and the former minister about this in 2018. But when we, Comrade Di Kaleri and I joined the finance family in Parliament, as it were, in 2014, and around 2017 onwards, I'm not sure, Professor Fowler, were you at the time a member? Some other board members may, commission members may have been there at that time. But for a year or two, you kept copying, rightly saying that, look, you're rightly so, we agreed with you that, you know. And by the way, for those of you who don't know, it's we who fought as a committee against the executive to say that the commission should have an extra full-time member and so on. Around that time also, we made it very clear to the then minister and DG that, you know, the FFC is communicating to the parliamentary committee that you feel, though your role is institutionalized in the constitution and you are an independent body who has to be taken seriously by National Treasury and other state structures, you weren't being taken seriously. That often, you know, obviously they're not obliged, colleagues, to listen to the FFC. The FFC can't instruct them. But they at least must give considered attention to what the FFC says, because that's what it's there for. And then say, okay, we don't agree with this, we agree with this, we don't agree with this. So at that time, and since then, you also get mutterings of the same sort, that you were feeling that you weren't being taken seriously enough. Has the situation changed in the last 2 years? Obviously, the new chair won't be able to respond to that necessarily, or maybe she's apprised of the issues, but have you been getting a better response to all the submissions you make? Apart from National Treasury, does SALGA pay enough attention to what you say? Not that they must agree with you. Do provincial departments do and so on? Do you want to respond to that? I know you have to be diplomatic in your reply. National Treasury's got its spies, yeah, it is, Cindy. The parliamentary liaison officer, I'm just teasing, she's not a spy. She's a very good parliamentary liaison officer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Karim. Any comment from the FFC?
I will defer to my fellow commissioners on that one.
Thank you, Doc. Okay.
Very diplomatic. Great. Yeah. Otherwise, you might find your budget gets reduced. Okay, be very careful what you say.
I think to Dr. Mbava, through you, Dr. Mbava, in the chair, it's best to leave that question to Trevor Fowler, and due to the fact that he's much more experienced in that diplomacy that Honorable Karim talks about. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Mohan and Dr. Mbava. You know, the Commission in the last few meetings, have really been taking up the issue about how do we look at the recommendations, how do we adjust our recommendations in a way that more of them are considered by Treasury. So we are making an effort to ensure that we frame them in a way that they can be more of our recommendations can be taken into account. But, you know, we also report directly to Parliament. And one of the key questions then is that it's not an FFC role entirely. It is a role that we must jointly execute with Parliament.
Thank you very much, Prof. Lubabalo, any other hands?
Thank you, Chair. Earlier on, I saw Honorable Ryder's hand
I do not know whether he withdrew or maybe he pressed the he raised the hand by mistake.
Any further from the members, Honourable Ryder? You're welcome, Honourable Ryder.
Sorry, Chair. My bandwidth is fading me. I really wanted to input as well.
Okay.
Mr. Karim was saying, but my network is failing me.
Honourable Ryder, are you done? Any further input from the members?
Yeah, my network's fading.
So you are not on the floor, Honourable Ryder? Luabalo?
Yes, Chair President. I think Honourable Ryder earlier on, he was indicating that his network is giving him troubles, Chair. I do not know whether it has improved now or maybe he's still trying to sort it out.
Okay.
You can keep on checking it, Chair President.
Okay, any further inputs from members from the provinces? Honorable Ryder, I believe that he experiencing a network problem. Okay, for the last, can we double check again if there are any further inputs from the members? Okay, Lubabalo, I think we have tried to cover all angles to double check whether we have any further inputs from the members. I think in the absence of that, and any further anything from FFC? FFC? Okay, Doc, if none. I think we have received a very comprehensive report from the team FFC led by Doc and the commissioners, and then on the theme for today in terms of the effect of the COVID-19, and we have checked all angles. And the report, they have covered a number of issues and matters that FFC have shared with the Committee of Appropriations, and then we have engaged on the report and also taking consideration of the recommendations that was presented to the committee, and then the briefing that we have received as this committee, that we are accepting the briefing, and then and all aspects that was covered on the presentation. And then I think on this note, that we believe that this meeting has come to the last part of the meeting, which will be to thank Dr. Tambamba and the commissioners and Team FFC, and also all members of the Committee of the Appropriations on the NCOP, and provinces who are here, all the provinces. We thank you very much for your attendance and the contributions that you have made, and also to thank the administration, who is very hands in terms of making sure that these meetings are a success, that we as the committee, in terms of our mandate, that we will be able to fulfill our mandate in terms of our oversight that we have to do as the National Council of Provinces. So we thank you very, very, very much, and to thank everybody who is here. And then I think we have come to the end of this meeting, and to thank everybody and to say that let's enjoy our day going forward, and thank you. Thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.